From beach towels to tea towels, and from mugs to water bottles, the TNT Shop has it all. Browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Sonia Poulton on today's News Talk, TNT.
We're getting so many fabulous messages about the wonderful Hedley Reese. Chris says, Hedley is a hero. Just a bloke who asks questions. Says, huge respect for Hedley, a man of principles and wholly authentic. No, but I can. Lou says, legend, Hedley. Michael says, Hedley, what a hero. I'm just responding to Basil, who I can hear in my ear here saying, can you hear me? Can you hear me? Yes, so absolutely, Hedley Reese is indeed a hero. And it does take a lot, doesn't it, to whistleblow on your own industry. And I just have so much admiration for people who can do that. So look, I just want to look at some news headlines. Really, I don't know if you saw this video last night. Really terrifying stuff. It really gives us an insight into what some people call lawless London. Now, I live in London, southwest Greater London. I don't believe for a second that London is lawless, and I hate the way that people like to do down our beautiful, wonderful capital city, because there is so much to be said about it. And I adore London. But there is no doubt about it, there's a great deal of violence on our streets. And I saw this horrendous video, and it was on London Transport, and it showed a man repeatedly stabbing another in Beckenham, at Beckenham Junction, which is southeast London. And so there is a manhunt for this. And this man was also captured on camera, literally walking with this blade. But he has a COVID-19 mask. And now I don't know whether that's to hide his identity or just because that really tells you all you need to know about this person. But some of that imagery is terrifying. If you know anything about it, please do not hesitate to contact London Transport. Let me see if I can find a contact number for you. But you just contact the Met on 999 or British Transport Police. There was also a separate incident in Kennington as well. Kennington, again, is southeast London, but they are not believed to be connected. So hopefully not. But terrifying stuff. It is terrifying, absolutely terrifying. What are you talking about there in the comments? Yes, good morning. I've just seen something say the hole in the ozone. That has absolutely nothing to do with nothing that I know about at this moment in time. But good morning to you all on YouTube. I'm just looking at some of the messages here. Good morning, Synchronized Soul Podcast. Of course, Shin, Little Jam Sandwich, and Kelly. Women need to stop taking part in these games. Which games are you talking about? You're talking about the games where men pretend to be women. Like, you know, I'm pretty sure that is exactly what you're talking about. Obviously, the issue of men in women's sports is outrageous, to say the least, because what we often discover with these men is they are absolutely, utterly mediocre when they are actually competing against other men. They simply can't. There was one American runner, for example, that he kept coming in like over 300th in the race, and then suddenly he became first place when he claimed to be a woman and started competing against women, because obviously our physiology is completely different, and that really doesn't matter whether they're allowed to go through puberty or not. This is exactly why sport is divided a lot on single-sex lines and needs to remain so, frankly. Right, what else can I say to you before I am delighted to be joined, by the way, today by Basil Valentine. Do you know what? Let's bring him in and find out what he's talking about today.
Keeping the commitment.
I love you guys.
Unbelievable.
24/7.
Listen to you every day, have for years.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And I'm joined by Basil Valentine, who is TNT's political editor. Good morning to you, Basil. How are you?
Very well, thank you, Sonia, and good to be with you on this lovely, wet, and down here on the South Coast, extremely windy March morning. Honestly, climate change, what a joke.
Wait, yours is where it's beautifully sunny here. I'm in Teddington, southwest London, and Basil, it is absolutely glorious out there. I can actually see a skylight through our conservatory. It's looking fabulous.
Good for you, yes. But I mean, typical March weather, isn't it? I mean, struggling to get into the mid-50s in what I call old money, Fahrenheit. Just past 10 or 11 Celsius. And it's April next week, you know, People forget it can snow in Britain in May. Anyway, I'm the political editor here, not the weatherman. And first story I want to bring to our attention this morning is UK membership of Dignitas, the assisted dying Swiss association, has soared by 25%, with assisted dying in Scotland moving ever closer. There are now 1,900 people who, it appears, might jump at the chance to end their own lives prematurely if they are able to do so safely and in a medical environment. Esther Ranson, remember her? That's Life. Announced in December she was joining. She has lung cancer and called for legislation in the UK, as she said, I might buzz off to Zurich. I don't know how I feel about this, to be perfectly honest. I've got a friend who gets depressed from time to time, and he rang Dignitas in Switzerland to see if they'd take him, and they refused because they said he wasn't ill enough. And the danger is that people might just, you know, feel a bit down or whatever, and decide to off themselves, you know, almost on a whim.
Well, I mean, it's interesting you say that. So we had Janie Lazar on last week. She's from an Irish group which is engaged in promoting voluntary assisted dying, as they call it. And she said that the checks and balances are much more stringent than that, because obviously many people are concerned about what's been going on in Canada, what we've been hearing from over there. She said it oftentimes that's not entirely the true story that we've been hearing. But it is a complex issue, isn't it, Basil? It would be ridiculous for us to say it's straightforward, because on the one hand, I can completely understand why somebody may want to take control of that period of their life if they've been involved in, you know, a crash which has created such damage to their body that their life no longer appears to be worth living for them. And I do believe in, you know, sort of the personal autonomy of individuals and how we should have those sort of rights. Then there's the religious aspect. Of course, many people believe that it is completely a sin to take one's own life. So it's difficult, isn't it? And especially difficult when you have big names, big faces like Esther Ranson, who's seemingly promoting this.
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree. If it is, you know, a medical certainty that you are in for months, possibly years of suffering, pain and suffering, and that your quality of life has deteriorated to the point where life simply isn't worth living, then, you know, what possible objection could one have to somebody terminating their life early? You know, as you say, there is a religious aspect to it. A woman, Paola Mara, travelled to Dignitas last week after receiving a terminal bowel cancer diagnosis and said, it's really unfair that I can't do it here. But Alistair Thompson, the spokesperson for Care Not Killing, which campaigns against the legalisation of assisted dying, said that the surge in membership is partially caused by a widening view that the NHS is in crisis, that the hospice movement is struggling financially, and that we are therefore failing to ensure the availability of good quality palliative care, which of course includes being pain-free.
This is extremely difficult. It almost feels like this is all coming together for some reason, because obviously we heard yesterday about this incredibly widespread research and report into mass dissatisfaction with the NHS. I'm sure you're aware, as indeed I am, that there has been this sort of controlled demolition of the NHS for two decades, really. Tony Blair sort of put the boot in, then there was David Cameron, George Osborne, the coalition government, the Health and Social Care Bill. And then, of course, obviously throughout COVID, we were told that our hospitals were overwhelmed. We were encouraged to stand on our doorsteps on Thursday nights, clapping and cheering. And I just wonder whether all of this is sort of coming together with some sort of grand design. But of course, it's not only a religious aspect. There are many people who are deeply concerned that we will get into the territory of the so-called useless eaters, where our governments decide that some people's lives simply aren't financially viable according to the state, which would be a heinous state of affairs, Basil.
Well, they're not far from that position in Canada, are they? What Bill Gates has called the death panels, you know, where it's sort of weighed up whether or not your life is worth continuing financially, you know, or it's simply too expensive to keep you alive. and therefore we've got to pull the plug. Now, talking of pulling the plug, investors at Thames Water, pardon the pun, have pulled the plug on £500 million of emergency funding, raising concerns about the financial future of what is Britain's largest water company. I don't even like using the term water company, Sonia. The idea that utilities should have to turn around to shareholders and try and find £750 million to cover their short-term cash flow, else we will have even more than the 4 million hours of raw sewage pumped into our rivers and seas, is an absolute disgrace. Privatisation of water is a national scandal. Thames Water should be renationalised immediately, without compensation to the shareholders. And for my money, the entire current board should be sacked without compensation. I mean, it really is one of my absolute bête noires, Sonia. The privatisation of water and electricity in particular has been a total rip-off. The British people were swindled out of their national assets, and now we have to have sewage dumped in our rivers because all the money's been given to the bosses and the shareholders. It's obscene.
I negotiated down my water bill because I pointed out to them that we're not supposed to be paying for water. We're supposed to be paying for them to facilitate the water, right? And I said, these bills are absolutely obscene, and especially because my water company is Thames Water and they are repeat offenders to do with sewage. And so the thing is that once you actually prod them, it is amazing how they acquiesce because they know they don't have a great position in the first place. But I completely agree with you. And by the way, can we add to the renationalisation of the rail companies as well, please? Because, I mean, it just is absolutely obscene what they've been doing to our country, isn't it, Basil? They've been breaking it down. I'm all for, you know, I'm all for a free market, right? I am. But this is beyond it now. We're not even dealing with capitalism anymore. We're dealing with corporatism, aren't we?
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, when you turn the tap on, you don't get to say, oh, actually, I'd rather have this other water, which is cheaper. I mean, there is no market when it comes to one's water supply. This, of course, came as one of the sort of jewels of Thatcherism and is now embraced by both Labour and Conservative, which is why both parties are so unpopular. We've got a by-election coming up in Blackpool South and the local elections in May. Word on the street is that if Sunak does particularly badly in May, the knives will be out for him and the Tories will change the figurehead once again before the next election in October. It's not too late, and Conservatives have a unique capacity for decapitating the party and replacing it with somebody in their self-interest, basically. But it'd be very interesting to see Blackpool South. I think it's a marginal seat. Conservative Labour seat was won by Labour in 97 and held all the way through till 2019. So it's a sort of Blair Labour seat. I think that both Conservatives and Labour will be defeated by an insurgent, whether or not it's from Reform, the Workers' Party, or an independent of some description. People are desperate to see this uniparty broken up.
You mentioned Margaret Thatcher, by the way, Basil. I'd like to finish this report by something which amused me. And that is, are you aware the Victoria and Albert Museum have refused to display her many outfits? They say that she's a contemporary villain, and insurance tycoon Sir Peter Wood, who actually bought them, her outfits, for around £400,000, is absolutely outraged. But I think people like this don't even begin to calculate the long-term damage that Margaret Thatcher has done to our country. As the political editor of TNT, please just feel free to sort of tell people your views on Thatcherism.
I wrote essays about this at Cambridge, Sonia. The whole Thatcher thing would have been, well, first of all, it would never have existed if Jim Callaghan had gone to the country in the autumn of 1978, when Labour had done quite a good job. What was then a very sort of social democratic Labour Party under Jim Callaghan with Dennis Healey as Chancellor, much criticised now, but actually they did a very good job. But unfortunately, after singing that famous little ditty, can't get away to marry you today, my wife won't let me. Do you remember that, Jim Callaghan?
No, I think that might have been before my time, Basil.
That was the Labour Party conference in the autumn of 1978. Anyway, Callaghan decided to soldier on until the following spring, and we had the winter of discontent, resulting in the first Conservative government under Thatcher, May 1979. So first of all, she wouldn't have got in the first place if Jim had had the sense to call an election 6 months
ago. Jim!
Anyway, he got in. What happened then was she completely crashed the British economy. Monetarism meant that large swathes of British industry went under. Thousands and thousands of people were unemployed. Unemployment reached over 3 million. And the Conservatives were uniquely unpopular. The Beat, Stand Down Margaret, you know, I mean, she was...
Oh, yes!
Everybody thought she was abysmal. But she was saved by General Galtieri, the Argentine general who decided to invade the Falkland Islands. She wrapped herself in a Union Jack. We sent 40 ships, including Prince Andrew, down to the Falkland Islands, scored a relatively bloodless, though not entire, military victory over the Argentine. And suddenly she was hailed as a national hero, resulting in her victory in the 1983 election. Thereafter, between 83 and 87, she sold off our national assets, starting with British Telecom, extremely cheap. Everybody thought, oh, isn't this marvellous? I bought some shares last week for £1, and now they're worth £1.50. The so-called stakeholder economy. We would all own parts of these key British industries that had previously been so inefficient in government hands. Well, what happened is what we're seeing now. Water bills going through the roof and sewage dumped in our rivers. We were all owners of these utilities before privatisation, and now they're mostly owned by foreign companies and indeed foreign governments. A total nonsense. So she squandered the revenues from those sales and indeed from North Sea oil to cause a temporary economic boom. She was faced in 87 by the dreadful Neil Kinnock, who was painted as a Welsh windbag, which indeed he was. I could have beaten him in an election. So basically, this myth that somehow she saved Britain is absolute nonsense. She created tremendous division. She was a Philistine in terms of the arts. She had no real appreciation of the arts. She said there was no such thing as society, whatever. You know, personally,
And that, Basil, is exactly why you are today's News Talk's political editor. Exactly that. You've just been able to give us a brilliant potted history of one of the most destructive forces in recent political history. And on that note, we'll be right back.
TNT's Mark Morano.
And there's a whole history of this idea that the establishment, the powers that be, the regime in power, likes the idea of a little eco-terrorism to keep the population hungry. I mean, if you think about it, their policies, government policies of the Great Reset, net zero climate agenda, are quite literally eco-terrorism or a form of terrorism. It's, as Jesse Jackson used to say, it's economic violence, it's economic terrorism. Jesse Jackson used to say that about the Reagan administration. But in this case, it's the intentional collapse of energy, food, transportation, free speech, all to achieve and make us safer and give them more power under the auspices, if you will, of a crisis.
Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission.
At the
top of the hour, we'll keep on top of the news.
It's the most important thing we can do.
On today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Well, Basil's spontaneous takedown of Margaret Thatcher, of which I wholeheartedly approve, has elicited many, many comments from you all. Very impressive, Basil, says Shug. Of course, the unions played no part in taking down this country, says Chris. I never trusted her, says Chris Smith. We lived in New York for 18 months in 1982, 1983, and all the wealthy businessmen were singing her praises, but I knew shipyards, etc., that closed down would be bad in the long run. And Grumpy Old Woman says, my water rates have gone up to just over 1,600 per year. That is outrageous. Absolutely outrageous. Renationalise it all, I say. And then make me a union baron. Oh, no, that's sort of the language of right-wing press, isn't it? And we can't ever, ever go there. I need a shower quickly. Right, I am now joined by my next guest. He's a political commentator, Danny Armstrong. He's sort of au fait in both Russian and Ukraine politics, which is just as well, because I have an awful lot of questions to ask him about what on earth is currently going on. Obviously, last Friday, at least 139 people were killed in an attack on a concert hall in Moscow. The director of Russia's most powerful security agency said on Tuesday that he believed Ukraine, along with the United States and the UK, were involved in the attack. Welcome, Danny Armstrong. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, it's a little bit of a tricky one. Of course, I mean, first, we need to address what happened on Friday. Of course, it was an awful loss of life. At least 139 died. Croker City Hall on a Friday night. Families out with their children attending a concert just on the edge, just on the outskirts of the border of the city in Moscow. This has come just as a huge, huge shock to not just the city, the nation, and then, of course, the world further on. Now, the fallout from that has been much more, interesting, if I could use that word. Of course, as you're right there, Alexander Borodnikov, the head of the FSB. For those of you who don't know, the FSB was, of course, the KGB, which is where Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, began his political career. He's one of Putin's most trusted men in his inner circle. He said that the UK and the US, Ukraine as well, could be behind this terror attack. Now, I think what he meant by that, first off, of course, I mean, words get jumbled up in journalists' interpretations. Of course, the journalists were asking him, do you think it is the UK, the US, and Ukraine? And he said, yes, that's what we think. But then he elaborated and said, Ukraine is trying to prove its worth to the West, of course, to keep that money rolling in and to carry out the UK and the US's dirty work. Now, it is an outright accusation that the West was involved, but it's more a broader hit towards that Western collusion. Of course, as Vladimir Putin said when he gave his thoughts on who he thought was behind this, he said, we know who's behind this. We're just interested in who has ordered it. He used that Russian word, zakaznik, the customer, the one who's made the order. Of course, we know the men who've been arrested, the four Tajik nationals, who saw them in court or battered and bloodied. We know who has carried it out. We just don't know who is behind it. So that's what Russia is trying to ascertain, who exactly was behind it. And they believe, for the most part, that it was Western collusion with Ukraine as the perpetrator.
I mean, it is really interesting. Obviously, as you say, he offered no specific evidence for it. But what is interesting is the fact that they deemed to say this in the first place, because I'm pretty sure even though he was responding, you're absolutely right to give it context because it's so important. Oftentimes we don't have things contextualized and we need to have that to be the case. But some people are deeply concerned that this will be used to create some form of escalation in any of the directions. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, as these things are usually used by either government to their advantage, you're absolutely right in saying that these things should be given their correct context. Well, context get in the way of a good story, of course. When we get down into the kind of nitty gritty of what was said, the reasons why Russia was sort of pointing towards Ukraine as being behind it is that ISIS attacks, it didn't really match up with the way the attack was carried out. Croker City Hall, of course, the accent on martyrdom and dying at the scene. These men made a getaway. Even when they were arrested, they made a getaway. The fact that each one of the men arrested said that they were contacted online and they were given money to carry it out. Now, money doesn't really come into ISIS attacks. It's more deeply rooted in some sort of faith or some other sort of political motive. Those are the things that are pointing away from ISIS. Of course, it's been outright denied by, in the media, Margarita Simonyan, who's the head of RT, who's the government branch, the media branch of the Russian government, as it were, has outright denied that. Vladimir Putin has said that these are, that we have the men who carried this out. But what he's pointing towards, he said the neo-Nazi Kiev regime, is the fact that they were heading towards Bryansk. And Bryansk, for those who don't know, is a sort of a border town near Ukraine. He talks about a window being prepared for them over the border. Now, Bryansk has seen many, many points of conflict during the conflict with Ukraine. And the fact that they were heading from Moscow towards that town is where they're getting those suspicions from.
Right.
And of course, ISIS.
Danny, bear with me. Let us go to some news headlines and we'll be right back. I'm here talking to Danny Armstrong and we're getting the real idea of what is taking place in Russia and Ukraine.
Hear about it.
We're depending on our congressmen.
Talk about it.
The people have to stand up and say enough.
Now, TNT Radio News.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. A hailstorm has wiped out a solar farm in Texas, highlighting the perils of swapping traditional power sources for vulnerable green alternatives. Police are investigating the motive behind a mass stabbing in the United States, and there's outrage in Australia after it was revealed a women's soccer team who dominated an all-women's tournament in Sydney, winning every game they played, only did so because they had five biological males on their side.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk. TNT Radio. TNT Radio.
Ramifications of that sort of action. And we are back with Danny Armstrong. We're just discussing, you know, various issues to do with Ukraine and Russia. The fact that context is really so vital and so important, which is exactly why we like to talk to people like Danny, because what you'll get from a regular mainstream media reporter is immediately, oh yeah, UK's being blamed for this, but Danny's breaking it down that actually the thing is, when you present somebody with a question, it's very easy for them to come back with something that isn't entirely the full spectrum of the answer, and that is where Danny is coming in, and I think that is so important. So Danny, we were also just talking in the break about the video that Grant Shapps put out yesterday, and I found that very interesting because he was talking about how he responded to the Defence Select Committee when they asked about how we would fare in a direct conflict with Russia. And he pointed out that we would have NATO on our side. And then he started to break it down by the math. What were your thoughts on watching that video? Some of my thoughts probably can't be repeated on a breakfast show, but what were your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I mean, this has been going on for some time, of course, not just since the start of the conflict in Ukraine. It makes for great headlines. And what it also does is make a great claim for more money to be pumped into Ukraine. Of course, on both sides, in the UK and in Ukraine, that's hugely, hugely profitable. That could be argued as one of the reasons why Ukraine is not exactly up for negotiations for a ceasefire. As Russia said many times, they've been willing to negotiate at least something that looks like a ceasefire. But of course, with that money being pumped in, with Zelensky being named Time Man of the Year and having millions and millions of pounds whilst he's been in his post, who would really want a ceasefire? Who makes money out of that? Now, for Grant Shapps to be talking about a direct conflict with Russia, it's a complete contrast to what Russia is saying over here. I mean, that if you want to take Vladimir Putin's words, for instance, he knows that he's at war with not just Ukraine, and he's at war with the US and the UK and the wider Western world. He knows this, but he wants it to end. He knows that behind Ukraine, we have the UK and the US funding, whereas the UK seems to be poking towards a direct conflict with Russia. Of course, nobody wants that because we'd all be wiped off the face of the earth. Nobody in Russia wants it. Nobody in Ukraine wants it. And I'm pretty sure nobody in the UK wants it, despite them being thousands of miles away from the point of conflict, or maybe hundreds of miles away from the conflict. it's easy to say this from where they are. Now, for Grant Shapiro to come out and said that, to be directly point, as you say, poking the bear, it's something that we've seen, this posturing and this saber rattling from politicians on both sides. But it's not what anybody wants. A direct conflict makes great headlines, but it's not something
right.
that is.
But it was provocative, wasn't it? It felt provocative. It felt like a completely unwise move. And I just, all this kind of chest thumping, it was like, come on, you know. So are you actually in Russia?
I'm in Moscow as we speak.
You are in Moscow. So obviously we hear why and how have we allowed it that Russia is still the bogeyman? The Russia was the bogeyman when I was a child. How can it still be the case now, many decades on, Danny?
Nothing unites people like a common enemy. So it's great to have that bogeyman there. Russia, of course, has been sort of a whipping boy in the West. It's been called, I'm sure, before you were young. I'm not going to make any comments on when you were young, Sonia, for fear of any repercussions. But
don't worry. I have no issues with my age, Danny. I'm holding up fabulously, so I have no worries about ageism. Yeah, don't worry about that.
No, before that, it was deemed as backward. It was deemed as not part of the political global landscape. And of course, nothing unites people like a common enemy. So there has to be an us and them. And unfortunately, it looks like it's going to carry on that Russia is the them for the us in the West.
Do you think, you know, the Tucker Carlson interview, which I found really interesting, I thought that was really insightful, gave us a real look at somebody who has been so heavily demonized for such a long time. But do you think that might have changed people's perceptions in some way?
I think the main thing is the way Tucker Carlson is perceived. And of course, he's another person who's been demonized in the West. And whether the mainstream media would have given that interview the correct credibility, because I do believe that Tucker Carlson came over to Russia with decent intentions, with intentions to find out more about Vladimir Putin and find out more about his psyche, basically, because not a lot of people have a window into that. Not a lot of people have access. Vladimir Putin was, of course, how can we say, less than laconic. I mean, he went on at great length about history.
I know.
To we're going back maybe to the 1300s, maybe, and some of his points. And it was basically to give a greater picture as to why things are happening now and why he is he's carrying, of course, he's the latest in line of the leaders of Russia. And of course, he feels great responsibility to carry on Russia's aura, as it were.
He's a very eloquent man. Somebody said to me as a comment, a sort of jokey comment, they said, Putin can wax lyrical at length about Russian history, but Joe Biden can't even find which exit to take the stage. And I thought that kind of sums it up really in many respects. But the other thing that I want to ask you, because you're clearly somebody who has a real understanding about this, how much, if any, has Boris Johnson influenced this latest conflict?
I'm not sure about him influencing the latest conflict, but he certainly seems to make a lot of trips to get his friends in Davos to ramp up support for sending money over to Zelensky. And it also seems to coincide with when he has some heat in the press, whether it be Partygate or whether it be one of his new affairs, or whether it be something in his personal life that needs resolving. It seems to take the attention away from that. Boris Johnson's a very clever man. He knows that it's fantastic to be going over to Ukraine. That's why he's been over there several times. That's why he's been given an honorary citizenship of Kiev by his mayor, Vitaly Klitschko, the ex-boxer. He is a man with great influence during this conflict. I'm not sure if it's right to talk about him getting responsibility for the conflict beginning for the plane to be flown to Ukraine. Absolutely.
It appears to be benefiting him, though, doesn't it? You know, this is one issue. This conflict is one issue that when I talk to people in the UK, people are so incensed at the billions that we've been sending out to Ukraine. Do you think there's an end in sight there?
I think it was Julian Assange that said the gold is not an end to the war. It's an endless war to be washing money back from side to side. Of course, we see now the conflict or the war that's happening in Gaza. We know how much the US is influencing and is involved in that. So for my money, from where I'm standing, without any bias of where I live or where I apply my trade, I would say that so long as the US is involved and so long as there's a monetary incentive to send weapons, and of course in the UK as well, whatever the US does, the UK tends to follow suit, and that's been going on for some time now. So long as there is a monetary incentive, so long as there is a way to sell artillery or sell a product that the UK makes, such as tanks or missiles, and of course the political angle to it. There is a way to sell it in the fact that Ukraine is a nation where victims standing up against aggression. I think it will be endless. I think it will go on and on and on. If not Ukraine, in Israel and Gaza too.
Yeah. There's a lot of profit in war, isn't there, sadly? So thank you so much for joining us from Moscow today, Danny. And of course, rest in peace, all of the victims of the Moscow terror attack. It's absolutely horrendous, whoever is responsible for it. This has been Danny Armstrong talking to us directly from Moscow, and very gratefully so. Thank you so much, Danny. Have a really good day. Take good care of yourself. We'll be right back.
I'm Naheem Hines, professional football player and proud supporter of the Muscular Dystrophy Association. My mom was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy when I was 14, and I watched her struggle. But MDA helped her get the best treatments and care, and they also help kids like my buddy Ethan.
My name is Ethan, and I'm 12 years old. Thanks to the Muscular Dystrophy Association and people like you, I have more hope than ever before. From day one, they've treated me like family at my local care center. MDA is the only one that funds over 150 care centers across the U.S. to help provide state-of-the-art care for adults and kids like me.
For over 70 years, MDA has been transforming the lives of people living with muscular dystrophy, ALS, and other related neuromuscular diseases. They fund the research for breakthrough treatments, care, and cures. And MDA provides support to thousands of families like mine and Ethan's in communities like yours. Thanks to MDA, kids and adults can live life to its fullest. Join us and learn more at MDA.org today.
One scorching heat wave will leave me powerless to cool my insulin.
When the storm rolls in, my time to find a pet-friendly evacuation center will have run out.
I'm relying on luck, but who knows if it'll be on my side.
When it comes to disasters and emergencies, it's not a matter of if, but when. Take control. 1. Assess your needs. 2. Make a plan. 3. Engage your support network. Let's prepare so we all have a better story to tell.
This is the Sonia Poulton Show on today's News Talk, TNT.
And we are back. And obviously, just looking, it's one of those mornings, isn't it? You can tell that Easter is, I think I did say yesterday that Easter is one of my very, very favorite holidays in the year. It's something about the climate, the time of year. Yesterday, after I finished the show, I went out into our conservatory and I was able, such a blessing, and I was able just to see just the spring sunshine coming through. And it was absolutely wonderful after a long winter, although not a particularly hard one, in all fairness. Right, I am delighted to be joined by somebody, and hopefully we can drill down together on my loathing of smart meters, but who knows. This week, energy customers smart meters have been shocked to receive outstanding bills in their tens of thousands as 4 million smart meters stopped working. Now, for the last 10 years at least, there has been a substantial drive to have these meters installed in our homes, despite warnings that they may be extensively problematic. I am delighted to be joined by Andrew Montford. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning.
Andrew, I love the sound of your organisation. You are the director of Net Zero Watch. If anything needed watching right now, it has to be the Net Zero Agenda. Tell us what you're doing on Net Zero Watch.
Net Zero Watch campaigns for rational policy on climate. Climate policy, as you probably, I'm sure you know, is entirely irrational. We are doing things essentially on a on because it's a religion. So yeah, they do things because they feel they should do it. They take no account of cost. They take no account of impact on ordinary people. And they just pursue this crazy, crazy agenda. So we're trying to put things back on an even keel. We talk a lot about the costs, and we talk about a lot about the impacts on ordinary people. And I think we're making quite a lot of headway because the cost agenda is coming to the forefront of the public discussion. So yeah, we're doing well, we think.
All those climate alarmists, they're like a cult, aren't they? And the way they go on, I find them extremely scary in some respects. You know, we have obviously like Extinction Rebellion with their really odd costumes. They look so cult-like. And then, of course, you have the great Greta Thunberg, who scared the life out of us all and made us think, goodness me, 16 years old, where are her parents? But Andrew, what are your thoughts about smart meters?
Smart meters. I actually wrote a paper about smart meters two or three Ooh. Years ago. It's something I've looked at in quite a lot of detail. Essentially, what smart meters are designed to do is to paper over the cracks or some of the cracks in the net zero agenda. As I think, you know, it's quite widely known, wind and solar power are intermittent. So if the wind isn't blowing, there is a major problem. Now, one of the things people talk about is they say we're going to store electricity in batteries or in, you know, maybe with hydrogen. Those are ridiculously expensive solutions. So one of the other things they're looking at, therefore, is what is euphemistically called demand management. And what it really means is getting people and businesses to switch off. Initially, they will try to pay people to switch off, and there are schemes there to actually pay businesses, large energy users, to just switch off when the wind isn't blowing. But because you can get very long periods with no wind, I mean, you can get 2 or 3 weeks with very low temperatures and literally no wind. I don't know whether you remember the winter of 2010, where I live up in Scotland. We had 3 weeks of temperatures of around minus 10, and there was literally no wind, and it was the middle of winter, so there was no solar power either. Now, in a world where everybody's heating their homes with heat pumps, electrical heat pumps, that is potentially disastrous. What would happen would be that there would be more demand than supply, and the grid would fall over. So what they have to do then is to have a way to control the amount of electricity that people use. And that's where the smart meter comes in. So mm-hmm. essentially, when the wind doesn't blow, you'll be switched off. This actually already happens in places like Texas, where they have a lot of electrical heating. And if the renewables aren't delivering, the prices surge. And people end up with bills of tens of thousands of dollars for, you know, a month's electricity use, because that's what you have to do to get people to switch off. It's really quite scary, but they're doing it anyway. And yet we come back to what we said, you know, you were saying before, it's a religion. Okay, so they will do this even though it is entirely irrational, even though it will damage ordinary people and businesses and the economy, they're going to do it anyway. Yeah, this is something that really we have to push back at quite hard, because it is not going to be good for ordinary people. The poor will be hit the hardest.
Always. It's always the way, isn't it? Some of the letters that we receive from the energy company, because I've absolutely steadfastly refused to have a smart meter. And some of the correspondence that we receive makes it sound sometimes as if they're almost mandatory, which they're not, are they?
That is absolutely right. Like you, I have resisted this fiercely. And, you know, every few months we get an email from the electricity company saying, yes, you have to have this. Another one they've tried is, oh, your old fashioned clockwork meter is now out of date. And yes. So we, you know, it's not giving correct reading. So, you know, you have to get a smart meter. And we just steadfastly refuse. And my understanding of it is that if you actually go to the Ofgem website, it says you do not have to have a smart meter. How long that continues for, I don't know. My guess is eventually they will make them compulsory, same as everything else.
Yes, I completely agree with you. And of course, we heard, for example, Grayson Perry, the artist, he did this whole big thing on social media where he had, due to his smart meter, he was presented with a bill for £39,000. So they can say that the old traditional meters may be given incorrect readings, but it's nothing compared to the 4 million of faulty smart meters, right?
Yeah, the whole smart meter thing has been, the government's involved, so it's a shambles. They spent, £1 billion or something like that installing the first generation of smart meters, which ran off the old mobile signals. So it was 2G, the 2G network. So they'd spent all this money and then suddenly realized that the 2G network was going to be switched off and all those smart meters weren't going to work anymore. I mean, no. It's absolutely typical of the government. The other thing they did was they found that the first generation of smart meters, if you change supplier, they stopped working. I mean, it's just, it's absolute government shambles. No doubt the next generation will be, there'll be some other problem with them. But yeah, we have to wait and see what comedy that's going to bring us.
Well, the thing is, it is an absolute shambles. I was looking at your website, and one of the stories that caught my attention, because you say it amounts to energy rationing, is this whole idea of a time of use cap that Ofgem want to introduce. Talk to us about that.
So, I mean, it's part of the process I was talking about before. If the supply from the renewables isn't large enough, then the price has to go up to try and bring supply and demand back into balance. The thing about the electricity grid is supply must equal demand at all times or the grid falls over. So, yeah, if you don't have enough supply, then you have to reduce demand. You can do that first by pricing. So, what there's at the moment, your smart meter, you can have a variable price, so the price can opt to have lower prices when there's lots of supply, but then the downside of that is you then get higher prices when the wind isn't blowing. At the moment, though, there's a price cap which Ofgem puts in place, which is fixed, and obviously that stops that variable pricing process delivering what the government wants it to. So they're actually going to make the cap variable now as well. So what that means is, if you are on variable pricing, it will vary much more. You will those peaks to what you pay will become much higher. And so suddenly when the wind isn't blowing, you will really get very high bills indeed. It's not clear whether the sky is the limit or whether they are just going to raise the cap. That we don't know that yet, but my advice to people would be to stick on a fixed price tariff as long as you possibly can, because I think it could get quite unpleasant.
It's awful, isn't it? I feel that we're sort of in a game of Russian roulette half the time in terms of energy and our energy suppliers. And it really feels like the government is constantly operating against us. We've obviously seen massive profits that have taken place, particularly with like British Gas as one example. We've been, subject to this so-called cost of living crisis. People like you and I, our bills have gone absolutely through the roof. I remember, Andrew, what they'd said was that there was going to be an increase. We were really good. We were at one stage only paying £105 a month through Octopus Energy for both our gas and electricity, which I considered a fair amount, certainly for the amount that we were using. And suddenly out of nowhere, they were talking about £800 a month. And it was just quite extraordinary. Why aren't government doing more?
Okay, so yeah, we've been through 2 years of extraordinarily high energy prices, but that is the result of the war in the Ukraine. And we had the gas pipeline blown up, and shipping disrupted and all this kind of stuff. So that made prices extremely high for a short time, and that the gas price has knock-on effects on the electricity price. So I don't think we can sort of say, the prices we've had in the last few years are a net zero problem. But if you actually look at the longer term, if you go back to 2002, when we started putting in wind farms, over the following 20 years, up to the eve of the Ukraine war, electricity prices doubled. Okay. Now that was the effect of putting in all those renewables. Okay. So the gas price is going to come back down again. Next time they do the price cap review, which is, a couple of months away, it will come down further. And it'll probably come down further again after that. Things are getting back to normal. So the gas price is going to come back down, but the electricity price is probably going to keep going up again because we're putting in more and more renewables.
Got you. I've got you. So what a terrible catch-22 for the consumer, though.
Yeah, there is absolutely no way out for the consumer here. Westminster is in the grip of the religion, okay? So all the main political parties are gripped by this. There is a small group within the Conservative Party who are fighting against it, but the Conservative Party is split on the issue. Labour are fully on board with the net zero agenda.
Oh, Lord.
The Democrats, the Greens.
Yes.
So we've got Reform, who obviously are not in Westminster at the moment, but they are the only hope for the consumer is that they are the ones who are saying, okay, we are going to do away with the net zero agenda. I think after the election, I think two things are going to happen. The Conservative Party are going to realize that they're going to have to change, that they can't carry on being divided on this. They're going to have to pick one way or another. If they pick the green agenda, most of their electorate will walk. Their remaining electorate, I should say. Labour also are going to get a big shock because the cost implications of this agenda are really becoming, they're becoming hard to ignore. The thing I think people don't realise is that the whole net zero agenda has been built on, let's be blunt about it, it's been built on lies. The Whitehall and governments of every colour have essentially lied to us. They've said it's going to be really cheap and it isn't. And we've actually had Rishi Sunak saying we need to come clean with people about what the cost, what net zero involves.
Absolutely.
He hasn't done anything, though. He's just said we need to do it, but he hasn't done it. We've had the former Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Hammond, saying that the governments essentially have been dishonest about it. And again, there's no sign of anybody becoming honest about it.
We have so many questions coming in for you, which we don't even have time to answer. But one question, is there a way to get rid of a smart meter?
That is an extremely good question. I don't know whether you can go back to them and insist that they put in a clockwork meter. I've no idea. If you don't have to have one, my guess is you probably can insist, but your chances of getting your energy supplier to actually come and do the work are probably quite slim. I believe you can actually pay a private, electrical contractor to come and change it for you. I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer.
Interesting. Well, do you know, the thing is, Andrew, you must come back again because I suspect there's so many questions. I'd love to do a Q&A with you, actually, about this whole cult because I think it's so important. Obviously, they have all the money. They are working all against us and we need to have that pushback as strong as we possibly can. Everybody, this is Andrew Montford. He's from Net Zero Watch. Check it out on the net, www.netzerowatch.com. And we've been talking about smart meters. But Andrew, you have been warning about the issue of rationing electricity for several years now. And you've stated quite correctly that smart meters would be used for such. So thank you so much for joining us, giving some clarity to this issue that we all know is a cult, frankly. And thank you. Thank you for joining us on Thursday on the Sonia Poulton Show on Today's News Talk. And that sort of brings us very closely to the end of our show today. Let me go out there, check in internet land about what is going on, see if there's any messages here. Yeah, we've already asked that. How does one get rid of a smart meter? Well, with some difficulty, it would appear, especially if you want to do it legally. Always difficult, isn't it? And that's why if you can resist, please do. Also, just to say, are you aware that today is National Wear a Hat Day in the UK? You didn't know that, did you? And why should you? Because someone somewhere just made it up and they, you know, they sort of stuck it on a calendar and they made it official, because that's how these things work, right? And the other thing I want to say, which I think is absolutely shocking, we haven't heard enough about it, and that is how hackers have published NHS patients' confidential data. This is to do with the group INC Ransom. They have boasted about their attack on the dark web. This is to do with NHS Scotland. If you have data there, double check that you are protected. This stuff is deeply worrying, of course. And just to say, which I didn't manage to discuss with one of our guests, but it is interesting because UK grocery inflation is now apparently dropping to pre-Ukraine war level. Hopefully we won't all be fighting over loo rolls as we did back in 2020. But on that note, I just want to say thank you to you all for joining me today on this Maundy Thursday. And tomorrow is, of course, Good Friday. We will be here, as you expect. Stick around, a whole raft of brilliant shows coming up on today's News Talk, and have a terrific day, because you're always worth it. Take good care of yourself.